Hi, Sam.
Hello, Chris. Hi.
Hi. Samuel, can I stop?
Yes, thank you. Are you? Well,
yeah,
I'm nervous.
Yeah. Are you nervous? Are you nervous?
Yeah.
Oh, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You might.
Yeah, I'm 88 and my memory's not what it was.
Yeah, I know. Well, don't worry too much because we'll prompt you as we go along. Pieces got plenty
you.
Of
okay.
questions to
thank
ask you.
You.
And usually with these things, after 5 or so minutes, people start to relax a little bit. So don't worry if you're a bit nervous to begin with. That's quite understandable.
Okay,
and
thank
very,
you.
Very
no, thank
normal.
You.
So Samuel, can you start by telling me your full name, your date of birth, and where you were born, please?
Yes, it's Samuel Andrew Deeth. Mm-hmm. And the spelling, would you like me to spell it for you?
Deeth. Yeah, that's great.
You probably got it correct anyway. It's D. apostrophe, a capital E, small a, T-H-E, Deeth.
Wow.
It rhymes with teeth.
Teeth. where does that name come from? Where's the origin? Where does it originate?
Well, I don't know. I've been trying to trace it, but nobody to ask, really. But it could come from a place called Dath in Belgium, D apostrophe A-T-H, I'm told.
Right.
Or the name occurred in Belgium in the 18th century, apparently, when there was a persecution of the Huguenots, the Protestant Huguenots, and they fled from Belgium and settled in parts of the UK,
right.
The southeast particularly, and the name does occur there. Now, whether that's so, but also I've also heard that it's another name for a picker up of faggots. I prefer the Belgian version, and also the character in the medieval plays of death, because I know it was spelled D-E-A-T-H, death, and
right.
over the years they've stuck an E on the end, put an apostrophe in and put a capital E, so it doesn't look too much like death,
like
I think
death,
that's,
yeah.
But it was deep when I was at the Blue Coat. The spelling that you've got now, was it the Blue Coat? Because I've got my, birth certificates and that. So
That's fascinating. I've never heard that surname before. Date of birth, Samuel. And,
oh, sorry.
Yeah, and where
21st of November,
right.
1931.
Wow, and you were born in Liverpool.
I was born in. Do you want my address? I was born in Edge Hill, Liverpool.
Okay.
By Myrtle Street, 6 Stanley Place. It was actually
right. Wow.
Liverpool 7, but it's no longer the house is no longer there.
No, they've all been
knocked
down.
Went back years
down.
Ago, and it's all gone. Yeah.
Great. Can you tell me a little bit about your early life, Samuel? A bit about your mum, your dad, your siblings, what your dad
well,
did?
Well, my mum, it was... Are you there? I'm sorry, the line seems to be...
Yeah, we're still here,
Well, my father, he was in the First World War, I think, because he was about 25 or 26 when the First World War...
Yeah.
You know, this happened. He was ineligible to be called up. But I know nothing about that side of it. My sister's daughter got in touch with me a few years ago and said that she was my sister's daughter. And I asked about my father. And my sister, said that one day she would tell me, he died of his war wounds. But I know nothing about that.
Wow.
He died, according to the certificate, from myocarditis and chronic bronchitis. I never knew him to work. He was always at home, always ill, had a very bad chest.
Mm.
And he died when he was 53 in January 1941.
Mm.
And then my mother died from gastric perforations and post-operative of pneumonia, age 44, in July 1941.
Oh,
and
dear.
It was just a little mix-up. I didn't know where I was, really. But I had 2 sisters, but they were 10 years older than me.
Yeah.
And one of them had married, and I didn't know she was my sister. not until much later on, came to light that she was my sister, because she was never at home. She always used to call down the gate, or she was just a family friend. But anyway, that was it, really. I just...
So you lost both your parents when you were only 10?
I lost
10?
Both parents. I was only nine, and I lost them. I was nine, and then I went to live with my sister, who I didn't know was my sister. I went to live with her and her husband, and I had a horrendous time.
He beat you, it was just
violence. He used to hit the sister, hit me. I ran away and spent the night in an air raid shelter in Liverpool just by myself. And I thought, what the heck, what am I going to do now? Anyway, I went back to, it wasn't far from where I lived, where I played. I went back and played with my friends in the street. And my sister came for me and took me back home. And he had a whole pile of jam putties, as we call them, jam and bread. And he had them on the plate. And he says, when you've eaten that, I'm going to belt you, you know. And he had a strap on the end of the back of the chair. And of course, as soon as I'd eaten, at least he fed me first. So I have to be thankful for that. And then he belted living daylights out of me. And then he just got me in. And then he moved where he lived, Angela Street it was, in Liverpool. And then he moved to Tubrook. But he was horrible. And my niece bears that out. She said he was a horrible dad. And my sister was very gentle sort. And I know he beat her. And anyway, he got me into the Blue Coats. And I only saw my sister once whilst I was in the Blue Coats. An aunt, my father's sister, turned up out of the blue and arranged for me to meet my sister. And she was gaunt and thin. You know, she was very thin and very ill, really. And I only saw her for about a quarter an hour, 20 minutes. And then I never saw her again. And...
This was the sister you'd been living with.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, they moved from Angela Street in Liverpool. I've forgotten the district now. Isn't it Edgehill? Yeah, wasn't far away because I walked there when my father died. When my mother died, I had to go to my sister's, and I walked there. It's not that far.
Yeah.
And I could tell as soon as I entered the house by the look on his face that. I was very unwelcome.
Yeah.
So,
How come you never saw your sister again after that meeting? What happened to her?
They put me in the Blue Coat School, and I wiped the memory of it. I just didn't think about it. It's a terrible thing, doesn't it, really? But I didn't think. She never had me back. They never had me back home.
No.
I stayed in the Blue Coat. When the children went for holidays, there was a little caucus of us stayed behind, and I was one of those. And then I went to my aunt, my father's, my mother's sister. She took me for a while. And then one day there was a horrible mix-up. I was going for a holiday there, and nobody came to meet me at the station. And the teacher who was with me said, well, you know, do you know where you took her? I was about 12, I think, 13. I said, yes, I know the way. So I got the bus and arrived at my aunt's house. That's my father's sister's house. And she was out. And I always remember when she came round the corner and I was sitting on the step in my suitcase. The look on her face told it all, you know, that I wasn't... I wasn't, you know, I shouldn't have been there. Yeah. And she said, your sister Rose should have had... You should have gone to your sister Rose's. She's got to take her share. They were trying to farm me out between, the sister Rose and her. But they never got in touch with me, and the headmaster did. You know, he didn't go into it at all. You know, he just arranged. He must have thought that I was still going to my aunt's in Wobbersee.
Yeah.
But so I stayed there for a while. And then I went to a friend's in Birkenhead, stayed with a friend's family there. But I just sort of rejected my family. Sounds terrible, I know, but it was the way it was, you know, in those days. I didn't want to go back to my
No.
Or the sister, but I wasn't given the option, you know. No, never said, there was no talk about it. The head, Mr. Walker, never mentioned going back to my sister.
Yeah.
And I didn't ask, so that's briefly what it was, really. But
so had you been,
the situation.
Had you been close to your sister Rose before, she got...
Well, she used to come to the house when...
When your mother was alive.
My mum and dad were alive.
Yeah.
She used to come and visit. I didn't know she was my sister. Sounds awful, doesn't it? But I didn't know she was my sister. She'd married somebody. Apparently, it sounds awful, but apparently she married this chappie, and he used to beat her. And then there was this other chap living in the flat above, and he went down and rescued my sister from this violent man. And he took her home with him. So my sister and this chappie who took her off this away from a married man they couldn't marry. So I think she changed her name by deed poll.
Yeah.
And they lived together. But then he used to beat her as well. But the poor sister was just a punchbag, and she was a very kind soul. I'm very delicate. No, it was just a so I just shut it all out, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I just blotted it all out.
That's a way of coping with it. That's a coping strategy that a child creates to cope. Yeah.
So your older sister that you lived with for a while was called Rose, is that right? And the eldest sister of all that you didn't know was your sister. What was her name?
Violet. She was Violet. She disappeared off the scene completely.
Oh, I see.
Right. I don't know what happened to her.
Yeah.
She was quite friendly with my aunt, my father's sister, actually.
Yeah.
And but I don't know what happened to her. I spoke when my niece, her daughter, rang me up. She said that she thought that she went to Germany and lived in Germany. She had a child.
Right.
Well, yes, Violet came to one of the Shirley Hall services.
Oh.
Funny enough, on the Sunday that I was chosen to, we have to have them memorize psalms or texts from the Bible and say them in front of all the audience in the Shirley Hall.
Mm.
And I happened to be saying one that day when my sister arrived, and she was pregnant then with... it'd be my nephew, wouldn't it? And then I saw her when I left school after that for a short time, and then I just lost touch.
Yeah.
So she didn't get in touch with me at the Blue Coat till Mrs. Violet until about just about 16 or 17, and I can always remember the opening sentence of the letter: "Dear Sam, no doubt you'd be surprised to hear from me for such a long time."
Mm.
And but the headmaster had opened the letter. He always opened the mail and read it, and he said, "Well, yes, you should have got in touch with you before now, you know."
Yeah.
It's all right for getting in touch now that you're going to leave. And he was very, you know, cross about it all.
Yeah.
But so I did go in touch. I did get in touch, and, you know, for a while, but I had no interest now. The family had gone, as far as I was concerned.
Mm.
You know, I sort of blotted it out at school. The Blue Coat was heaven sent for me.
Oh, good.
I couldn't wait. When I first went there, and my sister said that I was going in the Blue Coat, and her partner said, "So you'll be there till you're 21. You know, and I nearly was, actually.
What was the circumstance of you getting into the school then? How did that come about?
I don't know. He just said, "You're going to the Blue Coat School."
Right.
I think what it was, I spoke to asked my niece about this, and she said that he, as far as she remembered, he wanted to go to the Blue Coat in London, I think.
Mm.
I think it was Christ Hospital.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And for some reason, he didn't go.
Yeah.
He couldn't get there. And she thought that embittered him.
Really?
But he was awful. You know, he was violent. And he just said I was going to the Blue. And I was too scared to ask him any questions or anything. I just accepted the fact I was going. And I thought to myself, oh, good.
Yeah.
And when I got there, I'm sorry, I'm going on, aren't I?
No, not at all. It's fine.
I got there with Rose, took me, my sister Rose, and she took me for the interview. And I remember going, we had the interview in Liverpool, Church Road, and we went, it must have been the billiard or the music room, and I could see these cues, billiard cues on the wall, and I thought they were canes. I thought, oh, heck, you know, I'm not going to get cane. But anyway, because Dr. Dickinson was one of the, he interviewed me. I think there was a medical doctor there, actually, because I was supposed to have the tonsils out. I don't remember anybody else, and I had to read A Passage from the Water Babies, a Charles Kingsley member. And I was happy with that because I was okay with reading, you know. And then they asked me a little few questions about mental arithmetic. How many pence were in half a crown? I remember. I knew that was 30. I got down a couple of others. That seemed to be all right, I think. Maths was never my strong point. The fingers were working overtime behind my back. But I seemed to be okay. And anyway, the next thing was that I'd been accepted. So Rose took me home. I was almost triumphant when I said to him, well, I've got in, you know. And he just grunted. And that was it, really. And I remember, Dr. Dickinson came to the house twice.
Yeah.
He came once. He didn't come try them. And I was supposed to go to the Blue Coat. There was a date fixed. And for some reason, I don't know, I didn't go for the interview. Yeah. Then Dr. Dickinson came to the house another time and sorted it out with my sister. And so another date was arranged. And so I went then for the interview. And I remember my sister taking me to the train. I think it was Lime Street to Bangor, and put me on the train. And she gave me, funny enough, half a crown, pocket money. And I was on the train with a few other children, not many. And Dorothy Smith, it was, I think, who was with me, the one who was the lady who was the head of the girls, Mrs. Dorothy Smith. And she wrote a book called Those Graylin Girls, which I've got here, and it was a book based on the Blue Coat School, about these children in an orphanage, and it was very old-fashioned, and teachers were out of touch and everything, and gradually a new teacher came, and the school changed, and they gradually got, instead of sleeping in dormitories, they had their own little rooms and so on. Mm. It was a vision of the Blue Coats of the future, I think. She was on the train. I didn't know her then, of course. She just a quiet figure sitting in the corner, making the odd comment. I remember going in the train going out to the station. A lot of workmen are on the line, another line repairing the railway line. They waved and we waved back, and that was it. I remember going to Bangor, and then we got out at Bangor. There was a coach waiting for us, and we got on the boat, the coach. And it took us to Ragman Street, remember, in Beaumaris.
Yeah.
And there we met Mr. Watkin, he was acting head, he was deputy head, but he was acting head. And he introduced himself. I always remember, he said, "My name is Mr. Watkin, and I want you all to work hard." And then there was a senior prefect there, and he helped Mr. Watkin with us. You know, we got blue coat clothes. Well, we had a bath, that's right. They bathed us, fed us, and then we got changed into blue coat clothes. And I'll never, never, ever forget getting into new clothes at the school. How excited I felt. Oh. I never felt that. I was overwhelmed with excitement. I didn't say anything, of course, didn't show anything, but I was so excited about it. It sounds strange, doesn't it? But it was overwhelming, the feeling of having new clothes, I've been fed back, and I felt like $1 million.
Wow. I was just going to say, Samuel, it sounds like your first impressions were really positive.
Oh, they were. Mm. Absolutely. I know there were snags, there were ups and downs. I wasn't saying it was all beer and skittles. It wasn't, you know. But on the whole, I think the Blue Coats was, you know, saved me, really. Mm. I think it's no exaggeration to say. I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't gone.
Wow.
But it certainly put me on the right path, you know, pointed. Yeah. It had its snags, of course, but then there were hard days, weren't there, with World War.
Absolutely.
And,
well, yes, I mean, was it
cash
quite...
The cash flow must have been, you know, dicey, and maybe had all these children, you know, under their care. It must have been hard, but we didn't think about that when we were children. I was just glad to be there, away from that. And I always, always regret that I never got in touch with this. Well, only for that brief moment. I just lost the family completely.
Well, I mean, it seems like, you know, they wholeheartedly rejected you. So you seem to be passed around like a package. So it's not surprising. Tell me briefly, was it quite a fearful time to be in Liverpool during the war? I mean, was that another good reason to get out?
It was, because I didn't... Pardon?
Was that another good reason to get out of Liverpool?
I didn't think of that, actually. We were there for the... I was there for the Blitz, all the Blitz. When I went in 1942, we'd had the May Blitz in Liverpool, and our house was very, very nearly hit, so around us, our houses were being bombed.
Mm.
We had an air raid shelter in the cellar. It was corrugated iron on the ceiling, held up by metal poles, which were encased in a concrete square. And when the sirens went, warning, we just went in the cellar. I don't think it would have... If we'd had a direct hit on the house, it wouldn't have stayed. But I suppose it was better than nothing, you know. And there was an air raid shelter in the street, actually, but nobody went into it, as far as I knew.
Mm.
So all the when I went to the Blue Coat, 1942, February, I think, it was end of January, February, most of the raids had finished. I think there were one or two sporadic raids later on. But I didn't think of it in terms of getting away from the bombing. I just accepted the bombing, you know, it just... because my mum and dad were alive anyway, most of it. So it was just that I was just glad to be away from the family, you know, from the sister and her partner.
Sounds like it was a safe haven for you going to.
Well, it was, and of course, it was safe for many air raids. Of course, there were. I think there were one or two air raids in 1942. I'm not sure. But there was never anything in Beaumaris, you know. Where I just, it was just like a new world. I just entered a new world. And it's a lovely country. It's a lovely part of the country. I wasn't used to, I was born in a back street. I wasn't used to mountains and the Menai Straits and the grass and the fields and the cows and the horses and all the country, you know, picking blackberries and so on. It was quite a new experience for me. I don't suppose I fully appreciated at the time, but I certainly do and do now. I did when I left, but you know, that was just the way it was, really.
Yeah.
So, what was the schooling like in Paris? Did you learn very much? Do you reckon?
It was when I went to Paris. So we were billeted. We called them our host and hostess, and I was with a baker who had a baker's shop, and we went to the local school, Bryn it was called, yes, Bryn.
That's right,
it was a converted house, and we had our schooling there, and I think it was, it must have been pretty basic, but it's all right, and we taught us Shakespeare and French, and one of the horrific moments is when Mr. Watkin... Is it all right if I speak like this? I'm sorry.
Absolutely. It's great. Well, you know, carry on,
Mr. Watkin mimicked me in front of the class. He asked me a question, and I answered it, and he mimicked me with a very strong Liverpool accent. I must have had a strong Liverpool accent.
Oh.
And I felt terrible, and for that, I'm sure from that moment I never spoke with a poor accent. We used to have speech lessons actually for Mrs. Smith in Bryn. She, you know, we carried the spare chair up the steep stair, you know, that sort of thing. But
yeah,
we're all Liverpool lads, so I wasn't aware I had an accent, except
no.
when I lived with my sister, there was one occasion when her partner, he called a tram car a car, I think.
Yeah.
And I imitated that just to please him.
Yeah.
You know how you try to please those you're frightened of.
That's right.
And whether I picked anything up there, I don't know. But but Mr. Watkin brought it home in no uncertain manner that I spoke with a Liverpool accent, which I dropped. And, that was there. But the rest of schooling, I liked Mrs. Smith because she taught us English literature. And I thought she was very good. And I always remember she started off with The Merchant of Venice, and the opening lines were, she'd tell us a story first in an exciting way, and then we started off with the opening lines, "In sooth, I know not why I'm so sad, it wearies me," you say, "it wearies you," I think that's something like that, "it wearies you," and she was saying, you know, she was discussing the fact that Antonio spoke these lines. He was worried about something that might be going to happen to his ships, you know.
Mm.
And he had a fear that something was going to happen. She said, "Now, what do you call it?" And she introduced the word, the presentiment. And I always remember a presentiment. She said something, a foreboding that something's going to happen.
Yeah.
Bad, you know, something bad's going to happen. And she'd introduce words like that, and propinquity, nearness. I remember using these words.
Mm.
And they fascinated me. And she's read poetry and so on, and I liked their lessons. But we used to have music lessons there, and I was reading an article the other day about from an ex-Brookhope girl, and she said she remembers Bryn, and she remembers the boys with boots on, clambering up the stairs, all this clatter of boots, and they only ever sang one of the song. One of the seafaring songs. I can't remember what it was now. And it's not true. We did sing a couple, but not many. We had "Where Have You Been All the Day, Billy Boy," and "On Friday Morn," when "Boney Was a Warrior." She said that's all she ever heard. "Boney Was a Warrior," but we sang a couple of other songs. And it was Mr. Borden, the music master. He was a Welshman. He used to come to the school and take us for music. But I enjoyed singing and everything. The only thing I didn't enjoy was art. I couldn't draw for toffee and maths as well. But Mr. Watkin put the fear of God into me in maths, so I can't blame him really, but, you know. Mr. Watkin and Matt and me were strangers. We were never properly introduced, I don't think. I never really understood. But anyway, that was...
So then when you moved back after the war, you came back to Wavertree site, and was that quite a... Were you shell-shocked when you came back to Liverpool?
No. When we came back, we had a long holiday, long summer holiday. I thought I was never going to go back.
Mm.
And anyway, when we got, because of course it had been used as part of the War Office, I think. The building. It was tracing missing persons, something like that. Something to do with the war.
That's right. It was part of the War Office, and you're quite right. It was the Department for Missing Persons.
They had to get it all ready for us. It must have been an absolute nightmare for the staff, Mr. Watkin. It must have been. We just went back, you know.
Very different atmosphere, though.
Pardon?
A very different atmosphere.
The atmosphere?
Yes, very different atmosphere in Wavertree compared to Beaumaris.
I always say that in Beaumaris, I played in Liverpool. I worked. Yes, it was a good atmosphere. But we had in Beaumaris, especially when I was billeted with the baker's shop. We used to deliver the bread down to people and to Buckley Arms and all that. Two of us, and we got six sixpence a week for that. But we had the freedom in Beaumaris. we could go out and play in the street. We played hopscotch, and there were swings nearby. We could go on the swings. Mm. It was just like living in a normal home.
Yeah.
And I had a home hostess. The only downside was that I had to go to the dentist once, and I had a tooth out, and it was bleeding like fury. And at night, I couldn't do my homework. Now, I was one of these little swats, I think, who didn't mind doing homework. Yeah. And I tried it, and the blood went all over my book. And I remember the hostess saying, Mrs. Davis, saying, "Oh, don't do that now. Go to bed, sort of thing. Don't worry about your homework." So I didn't. Mm. But the next day, I was sent for, and it wasn't Mr. Watkin. Then Mr. Heritage was the headmaster. He was headmaster for a couple of years, Mr. Heritage.
Mm.
He came, was headmaster, and then he left. And he sent for me, and he wanted to know why. And I told him, and he just got his belt and just, you know, gave me six strokes on the bottom.
Oh.
And I thought that was unjust, because, and I thought the hostess should have really written the notes or something, but I don't know. It was just, I felt that was very unjust.
Yeah, yeah.
But, we actually asked to leave Mr. and Mrs. Davis, a few of us there, because one of the prefects used to come and slipper us at night in our pyjamas. We were in our pyjamas, they'd come with the slipper and, you know, use it on us at night, talking in bed or for making a bit of a noise and that. So in the end, we got fed up with it and asked to go to Woodgarth, the hostel there, and we went there. But to go to Liverpool, I found it okay. I was older, of course, knew a bit more.
Yeah.
But I found it, there was less freedom there. I remember my friend and I went for a walk once. And we just went out for a walk in the evening.
Mm.
And he was a clever chap, and he was talking about Aristotle and Plato. It was a very one-sided conversation, but he was, And then we came back, and the duty master had happened to call the roll, had a roll call, and we were missing. And of course, Mr. Watkin went up in the air, you know.
Mm.
He really got cross with us, and we were prefects, and he demoted us. We got demoted to sub-prefect. We got our prefectship back eventually, but he wasn't very happy. And I can understand why. Two boys missing. Could have been anywhere, you know.
Mm.
It was a silly thing for us to do. But we that wouldn't have happened, I don't think, in Bemoris. That could only happen. They were all together in the school. They kept tabs on us, much closer tabs on us than they did in Bemoris.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I found the school.
What? Carry on.
I just found the school okay, you know. I just did my lessons, and I should have left without anything, really, because I stayed till I was 18. And then I went straight into the army to do my national service, 2 years national service.
Mm.
But while I was there, they took the school certificate. I took my school certificate when I was there with two boys and a girl. The girl dropped out, but the two boys and I stayed on. And we took our school certificate there in 1949. But I was 18 then, so I was well overdue. But I just, you know, the head never spoke to me about going to the sisters or anything. It was just assumed that I wouldn't be going, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
do you remember, Samuel, your friend Seaton Smith or Seaton Unwin?
Peter Unwin. Oh, yes. He rang me.
Yes.
He telephoned me.
His name's Seaton. Seaton, S-E-T.
Seaton, that's right.
Yeah.
Seaton. He remembered me. I didn't remember him.
Mm.
And we had some conversations, on the telephone. And we actually met up in Liverpool.
Okay.
With his wife and mine. And we had a drink and that. And a little chat about school. I've lost touch with him, actually.
Well, actually, that's the surprise for you. We've actually just had an interview with Seaton about half an hour ago. And
oh, right.
Yeah, and he mentioned you very fondly. So, yeah, remind us at the end, and we could pass on presumably his phone number to you, because he seems keen to want to catch up with you as well. So, at the
end, that would be great. Yeah, have his number.
Yeah,
we just lost touch, you know. You do. Yeah, he was living in down south somewhere, wasn't
that's
he?
That's right. He's in Poole in Dorset.
Dorset, that's right. Yeah,
yeah. We'll give you his number at the end. It'd be nice for you to.
That would be nice. Have a chat. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, were there subjects that you excelled at school, or were you good at sport? What was the things you enjoyed?
Well, I was quite good at sport. I enjoyed the sport. I captained the cricket team.
Yeah.
But I was older, you see. I think that's a bit of a cheat. But I enjoyed cricket right from the moment I entered the school, really, when they played cricket on the green in Bemorris. Yeah. I was watching the older boys. And I thought I could do as good as that.
Yeah.
I didn't say that. But, I enjoyed sport. I enjoyed running.
Yeah.
I enjoyed studying as well. I wasn't a brilliant scholar by any means. But I was okay. You know, I was average. I enjoyed my lessons. And I didn't like maths because of Mr. Hawkin taking some maths. It must have been something in me. Because he used to go so fast. And sometimes I would be sitting, he'd have his back to me, and I couldn't see the board very well. I only tried to make excuses, I suppose. But when I took the school certificate, I took the Oxford school certificate, and I didn't have to take maths, but I had to take a science, which I did all right. I liked science. That was okay. And so I got the school certificate. That otherwise I would have had to. I don't think you could do that now. I think maths is compulsory, which I think it should be anyway.
Yeah.
But I always felt I missed out in maths, really, because the other two boys who took the school certificate with me, they both did maths and did very well. One got this, not at all, they both didn't get distinctions, certainly one did. But he used to take them to his room, the boys, and coach them in his room, and I was left out. I always remember sitting once with a group of boys, and he was taking some older boys for maths, and we were in the same room, same classroom, and there was Mr. Watkin teaching these boys about geometry and you know, the size of a triangle and A plus B equals C plus B, and I was trying to read the poem called "The Deserted Village." And there was me with "Sweet was the sound when up at evening's close, beyond the hill the village murmur rose." And I was trying to read this, and this maths lesson was going on the other side. And it was a chaotic situation, really. But I don't know why that was so. I don't know. It was just, I don't think Mr. Watkin ever intended me to have maths. He did say to me when I was leaving, I could always take maths at night school, but I never did.
No. Any other memories that you have, or any other funny anecdotes, or anything you can think of?
I think I remember once we were playing in Bemorris, and we got one boy would climb on another boy's shoulders, and we would go knocking on the door, and we went to. One boy, it sounds so silly this, but one boy got on my shoulders, I think, or I got on, no, he got on mine, I think, and we went to the house where we lived in my Suffred, and I knocked on the door, intended to go boo, you know, and Mr. Watkin opened the door, and then he died. he'd come to visit. The host and hostess see how we're behaving. I think he got a bad impression, and we went through, and I nearly died when I saw him because I was absolutely in awe of him.
What way were you in awe of him then? Was it was it a fear thing, or were you quite inspired by him?
Because he used to cane you.
Okay.
He caned us. I wasn't caned that much, but I was caned by him, and I can't remember what it was for. Couldn't be that much, but I was caned by him. And he used to stand, so he used to go in this little ante room and put us in a sort of like a semicircle, and he'd go around each one of us, and it was quite traumatic. That it was,
yeah.
He wouldn't give you more than 6 strokes of the cane, but I don't think I got 3 or something. But it was very, very, you know, hurtful. You can imagine. We used to go back to the class, and you couldn't hold your pen. Man, the teachers were very good. They didn't say anything. You know, I just sat there because I couldn't hold a pen.
Mm.
And also, he'd slap you over the face now and again for various misdemeanors.
Mm.
And he slapped me once over the face for something to do with a mix-up over a school blazer. And I didn't understand this at all, as I hadn't taken anybody's blazer. Anyway, he found out that it was the other boy's fault, wasn't mine. So he said to me, "Well, I have punished you now," he said. "So that punishment will stand. The next time you do something wrong, I won't punish you."
Mm.
And I thought, no, that won't happen, and it didn't. You know, he forgot that. But he was a dynamic sort of character, a strange sort of man, I thought, in some ways. He was a very clever man, very energetic. He ran that school, you know, really like a martinet.
Mm.
And we just were in awe of him. It was just his personality, really.
Mm.
And also the fact that he could, you know, he could use the cane.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say things like, he would say things in front of other children, which I didn't always like, because I was playing in football on the field, I'm just kicking the ball around on a warm day. And he came and he saw me with my shirt off, but he called me an oaf and things. He's, you know, he really told me off. So, But on the other hand, he could be kind. He gave me a very good reference. He wrote to me whilst in the forces. You know, a strange mixture, really. I think it was just the times. I think the cane was very widely used in schools.
It was.
Wasn't it? I remember going... I became a primary school teacher eventually, and I remember going on my first teaching practice, and this class teacher had the cane hung up on the blackboard and used it on 10-year-olds, you know, and I thought, this is not right, you know, for talking in class, you know. So, anyway, so I suppose it was just part of the times, you know. Physical punishment was very much, you know, the way of controlling children.
It was.
In some cases, yes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. How do you feel you did academically then at the Blue Coat?
Well, I got my school certificate.
Mm.
So I did all right, because there were quite a few staff changes. I mean, I was taking geography, and there was no geography teacher, you know. I took scripture, and there was no scripture teacher. But they kept changing them. And then, in the end, a lady came, I was the only one doing scripture. The other two boys weren't, I don't think. But I was the only one. She came and gave me some tuition and so on. So I was okay. And she actually, I have forgotten her name. I know most of the staff, but I've just forgotten her name. I can't remember what her name is. But her name was. But she sent me little biblical texts when I was in the forces, little booklets explaining parts of the Bible and so on. She's very, very nice. I liked her. But
what about friends?
Academically, I think I was okay. It was average. I don't think Mr. Watkin rated me that highly, but but they asked me if I would be the editor of the magazine, The Squirrel.
Yeah.
And I said I would, but I thought, what the heck? You know, I don't know anything about editing a magazine. But it really was the head of the English, Ruth Nelligan, Miss Ruth Nelligan, who was the leading light behind it all. I wrote something, and Mr. Watkin and Ruth Nelligan wrote other bits of it as well. We didn't have a... I've got a photograph of us at Tinling's in Liverpool, the Princes, and it shows me and a few others watching the magazine being printed, which is interesting. And it's called, the caption was, The Committee. But I don't, the committee are watching the magazine being printed. I don't remember having a committee, to be honest, but my memory's faulty. I think Miss Nelligan got the contributions from all the other children herself. I didn't hold any committee meeting or, you know, have anything to do with that, to be honest. I must be honest about that. That's how that came to be. But it was great excitement, of course, when it all came out. And,
was this the first time the magazine, the school had had a magazine?
Yes, yes.
So it was something completely new
first,
idea.
Very first time, yeah. But as far as I know, certainly, I don't think anything was in days gone by. I don't think so, no. I think it did say in the editorial it was this our first magazine, didn't I think? Yeah.
And what was the purpose? What do you think the purpose of it was? Was it just to promote the school or get a better sort of sense of identity? Did it have any sort of aim?
I think it was to get a better perspective of the school, to be honest, I think so. I think it was a boost for the school to have its own magazine.
Yeah,
I think so, yes. And it gave good exercises for us, the children, to, you know, to write the little articles and poems too. It was a good English exercise. But I think the aim of it was to, you know, is the first magazine that was done.
It's
so, school really.
Did you have to round up the other writers, or did Miss Nelligan do that?
No, I didn't actually. No, I didn't. No. The cushiest editorial job I've ever had. I didn't have to round. We did go around asking now and again if people would do the poems or something, but it was all, they all came in, you know, everybody seems to. I think Ruth Nelligan got onto them really.
Yeah.
Probably in the classrooms and so on.
Yeah.
When she was taking them for English, she'd get them to write a poem or an article, tell them about it and vet it really. So,
did you enjoy doing it?
Oh yes, because I liked writing. I used to write little. Ruth Nelligan got me to write little praises of books that has read, little critiques, you know, synopsis and a critique of what the book was about and how did they rate it and so on. I used to enjoy doing that sort of thing. I went through a phase, a very happy phase. Phase in my life there when I did this sort of thing and I found I could write with reasonable facility. And I enjoyed doing that. And I think that's, you know, I enjoy those lessons, the literature lessons. On the whole.
Did you find Blue Coat a congenial place? Did you make friends there? Did you settle in?
Yes, I made friends. Oh, yes, I made good friends.
Yeah.
I had friends, special friends, really.
Yeah.
There, of course, we lost touch when we left. So we didn't.
Yeah.
One of them, I stayed friendly with one gifted chap, and we met. We teamed up after school, and after we left school, he wanted to do a poetry magazine, but I wasn't really interested, you know. At that time, I was busy trying to get to, you know, thinking about work and so on.
Yeah.
But it was very modern poetry, and it, you know, I just didn't take to that really. But we did make friends, yes.
So being a boarder, though, did that bring you all together? I mean, because we have heard some people talk about bullying and that sort of thing. How did you find it?
There was. When I was in Beaumaris, in Woodgarth, in the hostel, there was some bullying there. I remember once, there were the older boys, you know, bullying a younger one. I remember once the older boys were playing cricket on the pitch at Woodgarth, and we used to take turns to use the wicket. The older boys would use it for so long, and then the younger ones would have a turn. And it was our turn, the younger ones, and I went along with them. And the older boy told me to get lost.
Yeah.
I said, it's not my turn, it's our turn. Oh, he says, I don't care.
Yeah.
So I did the unforgivable thing, I suppose, in a school. I went and saw the teacher on duty. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't have done that, I suppose, but I did. I was so incensed at the sense of injustice, you know. So I went along and saw the teacher on duty. He went along. He ordered them off. So we got our game.
Yeah.
But the older boy said to me, I'll get you tomorrow.
Mm.
And I knew he would.
Yeah.
And when the next day came, sure enough, he got hold of me. He beat me with his fists.
Oh.
But I knew that would happen. Mm. I just accepted that. I knew that would happen. Funnily enough, the same boy, but also we had a system in Woodgarth whereby the older boys would clean the younger boys' shoes.
Yeah.
He'd beaten me one day and he was cleaning my shoes the next.
How weird is that?
Hard, but weird, yeah. So that was it. And also there was a boy there, I remember, who was a verbal bully, but I kept out of his way.
Yeah.
And then one summer, as a junior, I went to Walney Island with the cadets.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I think it was the first occasion when I went. And I was put in his tent to sleep, and he didn't want me in his tent, and he made it very clear, and I thought he was going to attack me, but he didn't. He attacked me verbally, but not physically. But otherwise, I don't think there was any. Why I don't remember any widespread bullying that I can remember. There was a sort of culture of fighting there when I was there. Who was the best fighter? You know, who could fight the other one? And you could make an appointment for a fight. It was weird, really. You'd say, well, I'll fight you tomorrow at 5 o'clock. and by that time, you'd almost forgotten what the argument was about.
Yeah.
It was stunning cold blood. And I remember this chappy in class, I had an argument with him over a song. Who was composed a certain song? I said it was so and so. He said it was so. And we got heated, and we both wanted to fight. So we arranged the next day, or that evening, in the dormitory. I had my supporters, he had his, and they arranged for us to be in the dormitory in Woodgarth. And the door, somebody would take down guard the door, and the others would be looking, peering through the windows.
Mm.
And I was terrified because, I wasn't really a fighter, but also I was frightened of my, I'd had two teeth knocked out, not in a fight, just in a game where we had to keep the tennis ball up in the air by heading or kicking.
Mm.
I went to head it. Somebody went to kick it and kicked my teeth, two front teeth out.
Oh.
So I had two crowns. And I was terrified of these. I thought, I'm going to lose these teeth.
Yeah.
And sure enough, in the fight, he hit me in the mouth and knocked them out.
Oh.
And there were two pins left in.
Oh.
There were only, there were metal, you know, posts.
Mm.
And they were screwed into my gum. And so I bled everywhere and it scraped all his fingers.
Mm.
So that stopped the fight, and we went to the sanatorium. We always called it the Knock for some reason, I don't know why.
Mm.
And we stayed in overnight. We became good friends. And, but the poor chap was killed on it. I heard later on when he left school, he was riding a motorbike. Motorcycle. He went to the back of a stationary lorry.
Oh.
So, but I met his sister at a reunion.
Mm.
But there was that sort of I can fight you sort of thing.
Mm.
It's quite prevalent, I found.
Yes. Did you ever find out who? Did you find out who was right about the composer? Was it you or him?
It was me, I think. it was one of those spiritual Negro spirituals, you know, we used to have.
Yeah.
I just can't remember that. I did know, and the title's gone. I said that it was written by Stephen Foster. That's right.
Mm.
Stephen Foster was the author. Beautiful Dreamer. That was it.
Mm.
The song called Beautiful Dreamer, which was the rage at the time.
Mm.
And I said it was Stephen Foster. thinking, I was right, I think. But it just, the argument just, it got silly, you know, it got heated in words and so on. And it ended up with our fight. It sounds so silly now, doesn't it? But it played a big part in our time there.
Yeah.
These sort of, all this infighting and stuff. You know?
Well, I suppose it's a closed community, isn't it? It's
that's right, yes. We had
these things happen in that sort of way. But
did
you mind sort of being in dormitories and being in such close proximity to other people all the time?
I didn't mind that, actually.
Yeah.
I showed my grandchild, got a scrapbook here with a dormitory, one of the dormitories in it. I think it was the dormitory I was in, actually. Somebody sent me a photograph of it. And I showed it to one of my grandsons.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, gosh, he said, you've no privacy, you've no cubicles. He says, like a prison. I didn't think of it like that, actually, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
It didn't bother me. We had to clean the floor.
Yeah.
We had a Ronic, stuff called Ronic floor cleaner, and we used that on a... We had like a big pole with a sort of rectangular thing on the end of it, on a hinge.
Yeah.
And you put a... It was always an old blanket underneath it, and you put polish called Ronic on the old blanket, and you push all the beds in the middle, you swept behind the beds, and then push the beds back, then you swept the floor, then you push the beds, and you put the Ronic on the floor, and then you left it for a while, and then you got a clean cloth piece of blanket, and put it on this contraption, and it's like a huge metallic, it was called a dummy for some reason.
Yeah.
It put on this contraption, and you just cleaned the floor, and they used to shine. And I've got the photograph of one of the floors shining there.
Yeah.
I thought, well, I might have helped the cleaner. But, that sort of thing. But we just accepted that.
Yeah, and likewise with being kept on site, because I gather you only really let out on Sunday afternoons to go to the Sefton Park or something.
Pardon? Sorry.
I gather that you were only let out on Sunday afternoons to go to the park or something, is that correct?
Yes, that's right. We used to go for Sunday walks. Oh, we used to go for Sunday walks in Beaumaris. I don't remember Liverpool. I don't remember ever being let out in Liverpool, because we must have been. We used to go to, a little group of us would go to plays. I remember Miss Nelligan taking us, a couple of us, to see Macbeth, Michael Redgrave in Macbeth at the Liverpool, the Royal Court in Liverpool. That was a big treat. Yeah. I remember going with Mr. Watkin to see Laurence Olivier in Hamlet in the cinema, black and white. And the children there made a heck of a racket all the way through. And I wrote, I think, I've got it online from your website, a quote from me reporting this, you know, saying how bad it was, you know. But so it's not only today's youth, you see, that use the mobile phones and cinemas. Or But they were really rowdy and noisy, the audience, the young audience. There were other schools there, you know. Because we were very prim and proper, you see. We were Mr. Watkin. We had our own little, you know, in slang, you know, there. And we had strange words we used, like dummy, you know, dummy feeling. When you felt blue or down, low-spirited, you felt dummy. New Dyke was a new boy.
Yeah.
Who else was there? Oh, Donut was a teacher's pet. Douse was hide, somebody's coming, or douse the light, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I can't remember any. Oh, Dreep, we had the Dreep or Dolly. That was someone not very alert, not very with it, Dreep, you know. The Bustle was the cheat. You bustled in exams, you cheated. you were cheating. And getting into a moke was, getting into a bad temper, or was in the right moke. Strange words, and I've never seen them written down.
So it sounds like there was a blue coat language Sublanguage?
I mean, donut for the teacher's pet. I just can't fathom that at all. You know, I can understand douse in a way and bustle, but, you know, some of them are very strange, yeah. And they used to use those words all the time.
Interesting. So what did you... I know you went into the army after you left, Samuel. What was your career after that?
I went to the army. When I came out, I went to work in the booksellers in Liverpool, Phillips and the Nephew. I went into the accounts department. Mr. Watkin would have smiled about that. I went to the accounts department. I liked it there, actually. And one of the routes I took, I used to take the money every week, I think, to the bank, just in a bag, notes and checks and things, just in the bag, with no email in those days. And I used to just bury the route. I'd go out to the front door of Phillips and the Nephew in the main street. I think it's Church Street, up to Midland Bank and Castle Street.
Yeah.
I might be wrong about that. It was a huge, huge bank, and from Whitechapel up to the bank. And then another week, I'd go round the back. And I went up, I'd go out the back door and go up Matthews Street and pass all those warehouses where the cavern was, the Beatles' cavern.
Yeah.
Because in those days, little did I know how famous Matthews Street was going to become. Mm. They were just like disused warehouses. So that was my first job. And then I went to Liverpool Corporation, worked there in just a clerk, really, filing and making records in books and so on. I always thought I'd like to be a teacher. I thought, but not I wasn't clever enough to be a sixth form teacher, anything like that, but a primary school teacher, I thought I could.
Yeah.
And I applied, and I got into training college in Chester. Training College, I did 2 years there and got my teaching certificate. And just recently I got a letter from Chester Training College saying that Chester College had been regraded to a university status, and anyone who studied there before mid-60s, I think, before it changed, you know, into a university, would be entitled to receive an honorary degree. Now, I'd moved up to Shetland by then, my wife and I, and we decided we'd go and collect. We could have had it sent to us, but we thought it would be nice to go and receive it from Inchester itself. So we did. Actually, we did. My son drove us down there, we got the ferry. He had the car, and he drove us there to Chester. We stayed overnight. It's a travel lodge in the Lake District, and then we came back home. It was nice. It was two days. It was beautiful weather, and I saw a lot of my friends down in Chester. You know, I didn't see anybody who was in my year. There were a couple there, but I'd never met them. The names didn't mean anything to me, but some of them, the names I did recognise. Received their degrees, they had them sent to them, you know, which I could have done. But it was nice to go to the ceremony itself. And then I stayed as a primary school teacher, really, for the rest of my life. Then I retired in 1989. I've been retired ever since.
Yeah.
But we've come up to live with our son in Shetland. Because he's been asking us, he thinks we need looking after, which we do.
Oh.
And my wife's got dementia. She fell out just not long before we came up. She fell out of bed, and she'd had a mini stroke, and this caused her to fall out of bed, and of course she had what they call vascular dementia. The blood supply wasn't getting to the brain.
Yeah.
And she's all right. She goes to daycare for 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday and Friday, and she's there now. They come and help her to shower. I put the clothes out on the bed, and they come and carer comes and helps her to dress, and they take her up in the car, not far away actually. They take her up to daycare, and they do various activities there, and she comes home about 3 o'clock. So
when you were teaching, where were the primary schools?
They were in Wallasey.
It was
one was in Poulton, no longer there now. My mum was at Kingsway, and I taught in secondary for a bit, but I didn't like secondary, so I changed over to primary.
Yeah. Mm. And so, what does your son do in Shetland?
He's a dentist, actually.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so. Yeah, so he's not far away. His practice isn't far away from here. Mm. And he does all the cooking. He's divorced, actually, but yeah. he's on his own here. But he does all the cooking, won't let us do anything. He hardly lets us get up and make a cup of coffee or tea or anything.
Wow.
No, you know, he does everything for us. He's been asking us for a couple of years to come up.
Oh. And
we've talked about it because it's such a big... thing, you know, my wife was born in the house where we moved from, and she's 80, so she lived there for 87 years.
Wow.
And I've lived in Merseyside all my life.
Yeah.
So it was a big change for us, but they're very nice people, and the medical services, the caring services are very good up here as well.
Great.
So
what are you enjoying it up there?
We came up at the end of April. And last April, so
right.
We're settling in. Just about.
So are you enjoying it?
Do you enjoy living up there, Samuel?
Yes, I have to say yes, because I do miss, we miss our friends.
Yeah.
We keep in touch with them very much, but I miss, you know, it's all sorts of things that, in fact, you could get on the, you know, you could go to the shop just around the corner, and I can't do that up here because we sold a car. It was about 15 years old, I think. We sold the car. My son's got one. We bought our son one. It's a second-hand one, but it's a big 2-litre Ford, and he takes us around. The trouble is, he can only take us when he's free.
We don't
buy a decent car, for example, say a birthday card, I can go to the local co-op, but they have a few there, but not many, and they're not, you know, nothing very much. And that's about 300 yards away. But to get a decent car, you've got to go into Lerwick, which is 23 miles away. So we can get the bus, which takes about 40 minutes, or if Paul's free over the weekend, he'll take us in the car, which takes about half an hour.
Yeah.
So I miss... When we're home, we just go to the local shop. There wouldn't be any bother, you know.
Yeah.
But it's nice. The people are very kind up here. We welcome us in, and we're making some friends.
And what's the weather like?
Awful at the moment. It's pouring with rain. But it's not been too bad.
Right.
You have a lot of flooding, haven't you?
The weather's terrible here today.
It's we've the thing that here are the winds are very strong.
Mm.
You wouldn't get a job as a wig maker up here. I went to the co-op the other day. The week it was, and my son was off just for one day, so I never off work. He had sciatica and his leg. I said, well, I'll go to the car, give me a bit of exercise and you look after mum. I went down, and coming back, the wind was so strong that the car stopped, and the driver said, would you like a lift? And I said, oh yes, please. I couldn't move.
Yeah.
So I got in, he took me, it was only a couple of hundred yards, and he was going this way anyway, but but they're used to it up here.
Mm.
We've been very lucky here, I'd say, with the telephone call, because I've been expecting the line to go dead.
A few
phone calls are made. Vodafone having trouble with the masts.
Just one last question, please, Samuel. What would you say then that the Blue Coat gave you for life? You know, did it set you up in some way? A lot of people say, you know, it really, gave them a good foundation for life. What would you say? With that.
I would agree with that, that's for sure. It gave me security.
Mm.
It gave me structure.
Yeah.
It taught me to be with other people, you know, to sort of take regard of other people. It taught us courtesy, actually, to be honest. We were always very respectful. I don't know where everybody was, but we were most of us, I think, were very respectful to the teachers. We respected the teachers, and I think it taught us respect and to work hard as well, and not to grumble, because we were very basic things there. You know, when we were studying, we didn't have any access. We had no computers or anything. It was all done with books and so on. But we learned to study in silence. Almost a bit monastic, really, in a way.
Yeah.
Because my grandson said he had to move around and everything when he was studying and have his earphones on. But I can study in a quiet room and, you know, shut everything out.
Absolutely.
Do that. But yet, it did give me, for me, I think it was a lifesaver for me, to be honest. I'll never be able to, you'll never take the blue coat out of me. It's always there. And I'm very, very grateful. Grateful to the school for what it did. I mean, it fed me, clothed me, and educated me.
Yeah.
And it didn't cost me a penny.
Yeah.
And I don't know how the finances were arranged, but I doubt if the sister or a partner or I just don't know that side of it, you know. Mm. But
right.
It was
brilliant. That's lovely, Samuel.
Just one final question. Did you ever get teased because of your name, your unusual surname?
No, I didn't, actually. I was thinking that the other day.
Yeah.
Never, ever did the boys tease me. What I did get teased with was the Samuel.
Really?
They called me Sam. Whenever they came, they called me Sambo.
Really?
And they had a little rhyme which said, when Sambo had an auntie, she went upstairs to bed. Oh, no, Sambo had an auntie very poor. One day she said to Sambo, I'm going to scrub the floor. Sambo didn't like it. He went upstairs to bed and slid it down the banister and landed on his head. And they used to chant this to some of the boys, and I used to get annoyed. And they were older boys. I thought, one of these days, they'll box his ears, you know.
Yeah.
And one day I was walking with a friend, and they chanted this song, and my friend turned around and said, slide it down the banister. He said, you can't even speak King's English.
Yeah.
Slide it, it'd be slid. And then it stopped. I never got teased after that. But never for my surname, no. No,
that's very interesting.
Yeah, it was the first name, Sambo. Sambo, they call me. Oh, dear. Yeah.
Well, there we go.
Anyway.
Well, thanks, that's great. I mean, one final question I'm intrigued about is, did the kind of Liverpool sense of humour come out? I mean, we've heard about the private language of the school. Was it, you know, were there people who cracked jokes? Was there that sort of crack going on?
No, I never came across it, really. No, you think there would be, wouldn't you?
Not
really.
Sort of situation.
You would be, no.
Obviously, Mr. Watkin had obviously beaten it out of everybody.
I think he must have done, Oh, yes, he is.
Well, that's great, Sam.
He ruled the roost all right, Mr. Watkin.
So we gathered. Well, that's been great. Thank you very much indeed.